Well, as I said a few weeks ago, I've always enjoyed Oscar Wilde's rather pithy and edgy observations about human nature and our idiosyncrasies. And with humor, he gently, most often it was gentle, but gently revealed much about who we are. He was the one who said, be yourself, everyone else is already taken. What a great philosophy for engaging life. Be yourself. And anybody can sympathize with the sufferings of a friend, but it requires a very fine nature to sympathize with a friend's success. I was thinking of another one of his comments this last week when we were working in Mexico. The heart is made to be broken. There was something profoundly moving about what we saw, and I suspect some of the hearts of the participants were broken during that week together. And I'm looking forward to having the group share some of those experiences with you next week. Another expression that is sometimes attributed to him, but I've discovered actually wasn't originally his. It was probably an expression first coined by the no less insightful mind of Clare Boothe Luce, who is the American author and journalist and actually politician as well. She was the one who said, no good deed goes unpunished. No good deed goes unpunished. Which is, of course, an ironic observation. We're reminded in that statement that no matter how good your deed might be, no matter how noble your intentions might have been, there is someone somewhere who will surely give you a negative response. I mean, you offer a gift and someone will say it's not enough. Or you'll make some gesture of friendship and someone will say it's a misplaced gesture. Or you will stay silent to spare someone some hurt and someone will accuse you of cowardice. Or you speak the truth to bring health and then someone will criticize you for being a bully. Or believe it or not, you'll go and you'll build someone a house and someone will complain about that too. Each of us have a list like that, I'm sure. No good deed goes unpunished. And I was thinking about that this week because of the gospel reading that was wonderfully read to us. Thank you, Kathy. Jesus and his disciples have run into a fellow who's been blind from birth. And the disciples, and it's really important that we note this, that it's actually the disciples who bring up this issue. They ask Jesus whether it was his sin or his parents' sin that caused the state of affairs, that caused his blindness. And they raise it because I suspect they were captured by the belief of the time that one's afflictions were somehow tied to some sort of sinful behavior somewhere in your life or in the line of your family. By the way, I'm not yet convinced that our views on this have changed too much, but that's another sermon. But what happens here is the victim gets blamed not once, but twice. The victim gets re-victimized in this line of thinking. So Jesus lets the disciples know that his affliction has nothing to do with sin. And he then instead turns his task to doing some healing. And what he does is he spits in some dust, and he mixes up a little mud, puts it on this blind gentleman's eyes, and then tells him to go and wash it off at a particular pool. And he dutifully does so, and he comes back. The man born blind can now see. This is brilliant. So what happens? Well, no good deed goes unpunished. All of a sudden, there's controversy. The neighbors are quite puzzled by this turn of events. They try to figure out what happened. And some say that this man born blind but who can now see, and just for the sake of ease, I'm going to refer to him by the name of Walt throughout this sermon. Walt kind of fits for me. Some say that the Walt really can't be the man who was born blind. Rather, it's just someone who looks like him. And, you know, yeah, there's some similarity. But that can't be Walt the beggar. And so they start to quiz Walt. And sure enough, it really is him. So then they now want to know, well, how did it happen? So Walt tells him exactly what happened. You know, there's Jesus, and there's spit, and there's mud, and he's washed, and next thing you know, there's sight. That doesn't seem to satisfy them. It just can't be that simple. And being the good neighbors that they really are, And when I say good, I'm reminded of Mark Twain's description of someone being a good man in the worst sense of the word, being good neighbors. They decide to get to the bottom of this right away. They're going to take him to a hearing of the church board. No, better than that. They are actually going to take him to a presbytery meeting. They've decided they're going to get the clergy and the church officials involved. And how could that not end well, right? So off they go with Walt in tow. And did I mention this? Horror of horrors. Not only was this healing not approved by the National Working Unit on Healing and Exorcism Visual Acuity Division, but this healing actually occurred on the Sabbath. And so there's this bubbling concern that this good thing might actually be a sin. Because remember, no good deed goes unpunished. They arrive at what has now become some sort of formal hearing of the presbytery, and the church officials ask the same question about what happened, and they get the same answer from Walt. You know, Jesus spit, mud, wash, and Bob's your uncle, sight. That testimony immediately causes a split in the courtroom. Some people think this is quite fine, but others have noted that this has happened on the Sabbath, therefore it must indeed be a sin. And so they turn back to Walt, and they grill him again. Come on, buddy, spill the beans. What's really going on here? And Walt says, well, since you asked, I'm thinking that this Jesus fellow might be some sort of prophet. Which turns out to be not quite the response that they were hoping for. And so what they do is they call in Walt's parents for some extended questioning. And this bewildered couple, they arrive and they're quickly asked, now, is this your lad, the one who was born blind? And if it is, how did this healing happen? And they say, yes, indeed, this is their boy, Walt. And they reply as honestly as they can that they have not the foggiest clue as to how he can now see. In fact, they're so intimidated by this hearing that they say, you know, Walt is a grown man. He can answer for himself, and we're out of here. Now, the clergy, well, they're unimpressed by all this, and so they call poor Walt back on the carpet. And they begin by saying, well, we know that this Jesus fella is a sinner. And Walt, and I love this in the text. You can see he's starting to get a bit testy. He says, well, I don't know if he's a sinner or not, but I do know this. I was once blind, but now, man, I can see for miles. Excuse me. Little aside here. I don't know if you caught this, but Jesus actually disappears from this story about halfway through verse 7, and he disappears for some 28 verses. That's the second part of the story that you divided up so appropriately. Thank you, Kathy. And it's just more than a little ironic that the one person in this enormous middle section, the one person who can actually see, is the one who was born blind. Anyway, back to the story. The church professionals, they ask Walt, So tell us, what did he do to you? I mean, how did he do this? And Walt, he's pretty cheesed off with these guys. I mean, he's been giving them the straight goods all along. He tells them just the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth. That's what he's done. I mean, really, he's been mostly looking to have some sort of party to celebrate the regaining of his sight. You know, a little slap on the back and isn't this wonderful, Walt? And how about a glass of bubbly? He was hoping for something like that, and what's he get? I mean, they're really bringing him down. And so he says, come on, I've already told you. What's going on with you guys? You want to be disciples too? Why don't you go ask him yourself? And the church theologians, they are absolutely aghast. And as typical of any church organization, they quickly issue a strongly worded press release distancing themselves from this Jesus. That'll show them. To which Walt responds by heaping even more scorn upon him. He says, well, isn't this a hoot? I mean, there's dripping sarcasm in what he's saying here. He says, this man opened my eyes, and we all know that God doesn't listen to sinners. You've already told us that, right? Just the godly. So logic tells us that if this gent isn't from God, then he couldn't do what he just did. And the church leaders, they just snap, they lose it, when they hear all this, and they say to Walt, "You are a sin-filled loser, don't you dare to lecture us," and they throw him out of the church. And he's left there standing on the curb mumbling, I don't get this. I was once blind, but now I can see. What's the problem with that? Well, it seems that no good deed goes unpunished. It's a strange, but I find very compelling story. It's a miracle story, of course. Miracle stories often serve as a kind of a sign in the Gospels. After the introductory portion in chapter 1, there are a bunch of miracle stories in John's Gospel. So much so that the first 12 chapters are sometimes referred to as the Book of Signs. But they're signs of what? Some will say that they're signs of who Jesus is. They point to the divine nature that Jesus also possesses. And I guess this is also supposed to make us believe in him. And yet the funny thing is, in this particular story, just the opposite happens, right? Instead of everybody getting all excited about this remarkable worker of miracles, instead of drawing crowds to Jesus and convincing the church of the day that he was the anointed one, that he was the very Son of God, what happens is instead they turn on him. So it's all upside down. What happens is that the people the world would dismiss as sinners, and in those days and in that place, a good-sized group of sinners also included people who'd been born blind, people with afflictions. Well, they were exactly the people Jesus would hang out with, and he would heal them, and they would see who he was. The sinners. And the very people who you would think would get it, you know, the people with perfect vision, the nice people, the church people, and yes, even the clergy. And really, is there a higher form of spiritual life than clergy? You laugh far too easily at that. But all these nice people were the ones who couldn't or wouldn't see. Now, I was blessed by having parents who gave me the opportunity to listen to all different kinds of music. The one thing that I still feel a bit conflicted about is my dad forced me to listen to speeches of Winston Churchill, but we can talk about that at coffee. But we had recordings of all different kinds of things going on in our house all the time. It was a place that was filled with music. And so we had different styles. And at a very early age, I was introduced to the work of Gilbert and Sullivan. And you'll remember that Gilbert and Sullivan were this pair of Victorian-era gents who wrote and composed some 14 immensely popular comic operas, operas that are still produced to this very day. They had the most brilliant melodies. They were written by Arthur Sullivan, and he penned a number of the hymns in our hymn books that we still use. And the excruciatingly funny lyrics were written by W.S. Gilbert. And if you look closely, you'll realize that those excruciatingly funny lyrics were actually a pretty biting commentary on Victorian society. The most performed and the most popular of these operas was one called The Mikado. And it has a song in it that's officially titled As Someday It May Happen. But probably most of us know it by its more popular title, which is I've Got a Little List. I've Got a Little List is sung by a character who serves as the town's official executioner. And as it turns out, he has this fairly extensive list of people who he considers worth executing, just in case you need to. But instead of the usual capital felonies, his list includes a variety of people whose crimes range from such things as having flabby hands and irritating laughs, to children who show you up with their intelligence, to, for some reason, banjo players, and I love this one, the lady who thinks she dances, the lady who doesn't think she dances but would rather like to try. So it's this long list of people whose crimes are, at worst, items of personal taste. And it's a really, really funny song. It's brilliantly written. And for those of you who like such things, I've posted a version of that song on our church Facebook page this morning, so you can give it a listen. And the artist is a singer named John Reed, who could perform a patter song like no other. It's just brilliant. Anyway, I was thinking about that this week, because I suspect that on some level, we all have some list of people who irritate us. We all have this list of people who, you know, if we were forced to admit it, we just don't like. And we can't stand them, or we try to avoid them because there's something in their way of being or something in their actions that just bug us. And I was so tempted to share my list with you this morning, but but frankly, I'm too embarrassed to do so. It's longer than I'd like you to know. And I have this nagging worry that includes the names of some of the people you might actually have on your favorites list. And then what would we do? And I'd prefer not to confirm your suspicions about my character, so we'll just let that disappear. Anyway, two Sundays ago, just before I left on the mission trip, you remember I preached on an earlier portion of John's Gospel, John chapter 3, verses 1 through 17. And it's such a magnificent text. Such a wonderful piece of scripture. And remember, it has that memorable line, "For God so loved the good that he gave his only son." No, it wasn't quite right, was it? No. It's not what he said. No. It's, "For God so loved the world." And that includes a lot of different people, right? There's some nice, some not so nice, some winners, some losers. There's good, the bad. And those of you who were here that week, you may remember that we noted that Jesus had this annoying habit, a truly annoying habit, of hanging out with sinners and losers and just general riffraff. And so I suggested that a helpful exercise might be to make a short list of the people you feel most uncomfortable with, and include all those people who you think might be in fact hellbound because of their politics or their theology or their lifestyle or their particular sports team, you know, whatever. Which brings me to what I think may be the message for us this morning. Those people on that list, those individuals on the list of people who most offend us, they aren't just the people that Jesus was likely hanging out with, but they are surely the people that he died for. And why did he do that? Because he just loves them to death. Jesus didn't need to die for good people, for those of us who can make it on our own, for those of us who've got our theology all perfectly laid out, who have done all the right things. No, he just died for us sinful ones. And this is, I think, one of the most offensive things about Jesus. It was one of the things that really, I think, made us nail him to the cross. But it seems that good people just don't need to be on his list. And that's okay, I guess, because they don't really need what he's offering anyhow. Good people don't need a savior. But for us sinners, for those of us who've figured out that we're far needier than we like to admit, for those of us who know that we really can't make it on our own, for those of us who've discovered that we're actually quite blind, oh boy, do we ever need that Savior. Yeah, those are the people he died for. People like us.